All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome to episode 37 of the SLS Cast. Yes, 37, the royal number. The royal number, if you consider that William Shakespeare wrote 37 plays in his lifetime.
Wouldn't that be more so like the Shakespearean number than a royal number? Or is it technically
just take the wind
called?
Out of my sails, Tim. Just do that, fine. It's fine.
Spread your wings and fly. You don't need
spread
sails.
My wings and fall flat on my ass. Spread my wings and fly into a building, much like the birds in The Conjuring did. But yes, definitely all welcome to the SLS Cast. I am Matt.
And I am Tim.
Wait, are you doing Chardonnay through a straw?
No, I'm not. It was for comedic effect.
Well, I'm laughing.
I want people to wish they were drinking Chardonnay along with me out of a floral golden glass.
Ooh, a chalice, would you say?
Sure, why not? We will call this a chalice. Make it a lot more manlier than how it actually looks.
Yeah, the chalice of Chardonnay.
The chalice of Chardonnay. Do you drink Chardonnay, Matt? Are you a white wine
Absolutely
man?
No.
Or do you like the tannins?
I do like me some tannins. My overall favorite just drinking wine is a Pinot Noir. However, for my all-time specific favorite wine, I love a Gewürztraminer.
Oh, yeah. P.F. Chang's had that for a while.
Yeah, and then my second little favorite is a dessert wine. Usually when you can get a really nice, crisp, sweet Johannesburg Riesling, that's also a great dessert wine for me. But my all-time single favorite wine is a Gewürztraminer, whereas my standard drinking wine is a Pinot Noir.
Oh. I'm just drinking Charles Schwab, Three Buck Chuck, Trader Joe's Chardonnay, which is actually surprisingly really good. Have you ever heard of the Three Buck Chuck, Charles Shaw, which a lot of people call it Charles Schwab, and I'm pretty sure Charles Schwab is like investment banking or something like that.
Yes, I would have to agree with you on that. And no, I have not heard of that actually. I'm racking my brain. No, I have not heard of it. How much is it per bottle?
It's like $2.47.
Outstanding.
Yeah, and it's like the guy, Charles Shaw, he became famous by taking the grapes, like the not the greatest grapes, and creating actually a really good wine out of it. So he's able to sell it cheaply. So here it's $3 Chuck. I think in Texas, where there are now some Trader Joe's, I think it's like $4 Chuck there, but still, $3-4 is not a bad price for a wine.
No, I draw the line at less than $3, though. I applaud your bravery in that, but I don't know that I could do it through. I mean, I don't know. Chardonnay is kind of, it's got kind of a, like, I really cannot think of the word that is descriptive enough, but
good.
No, I'm not a big fan of Chardonnay, actually. I don't enjoy Chardonnay. It's don't know if it's the lack of oakiness in my and lack of tannins, you know. Perhaps the mother is not strong enough for the vintage that I prefer. But for me, I find that the less expensive you go on Chardonnay, the worse it tastes. But only for Chardonnay. It's not something that is necessarily universal of wines.
So do you wear a skirt whenever you drink your Pinot Noir?
I do. We call them kilts, you know, in Oy. The Scottish land and everything, but yeah.
Because the Scots are known for drinking their Pinot Noir.
Well, you gotta work up the courage to fuck the sheep somehow. And, you know, that's just what we do.
So, whenever you say you're playing Arkham Horror, that's actually code for joust and sheep.
Well, I think if there was anybody who was a fan of the show that's Scottish, they're probably not a fan of the show anymore. yes, as Robin Williams once said, where men were men and sheep were scared. But no, the Arkham Horror really is a good board game.
Yes.
I highly recommend you try it.
One day more, I will try Arkham. Yeah. So I watched an interesting documentary, like kind of like on YouTube. It was a Siskel and Ebert special that they did back in 1990 called The Future of the Movies. And this came out on TV, and both Ebert and Siskel interviewed Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, and George Lucas about what they think is going to happen, kind of like prophesizing the future of the film industry. And I gotta say, these three guys, especially George Lucas, hit the nail on the head when it came to this stuff. And I just had to share this, because this isn't necessarily news or anything, so I thought this would kind of fit well in this little pre-show.
Can't be news for us if it came out when Siskel was still alive.
True.
Apparently it's been around for a little while. But enlighten us, Tim.
Yes. Okay, so like they talked about problems with the studios. Spielberg, you know, he set the standard for the summer blockbuster with Jaws. And so they prophesize that in the future, studios are now going to try to swing for the $300+ million mark in order for a movie to be considered successful. And they were saying in 1990, for a movie to be considered successful, it had to have made $25 million. $25 million. And they just said back in 1985, it was only $15 million. Now, it's what? Over $100 million? It has to be. Usually a movie to be considered a success and therefore to have a sequel, it needs to be in the $100 million mark. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
I gotta say, I'm not sure about that one. Only because the formula is just pretty much double your budget. Because you have things even back then that would take the public by storm. You get back in the early and mid-90s, you had Blair Witch Project was one. It was made for like $400,000 or something like that. Or maybe even less than that. It was primarily...
That didn't happen too often.
It still doesn't. I mean, it still doesn't. You still have those little things. What was the one that came out pretty recently? It was like a $3 million budget, came out earlier this year, and then was like something phenomenal or whatever.
Oh, The Purge. Happened with The Purge.
Yeah, there you go, Purge. So you still get those little deals. But I mean, primarily, as long as a movie doubles its budget because to make up its marketing and stuff, then that's usually your formula for getting it. I think if you want to consider something a blockbuster, then sure, it's got to probably... I would even venture to say it's got to be at least $200 million before they'll consider it a blockbuster.
Right. And actually with Kick-Ass barely surpassed its $40 million budget, and yet it still got a sequel. And I think that was only because of the fans wanted a sequel. But we'll talk about Kick-Ass more later on. Also, both Spielberg and Scorsese spearheaded the film restoration program. And I thought this was a little interesting tidbit for Lawrence of Arabia. You know, they found like all these old nitrate negatives of these films were kind of deteriorating. And one of them that was looking horrible was Lawrence of Arabia. However, during the restoration, they brought in Peter O'Toole and the director. I think it's David Lean who directed Lawrence of Arabia. I might be wrong, but I think it was David Lean. They brought them in to oversee the re-recording. And Spielberg was talking about how Peter O'Toole re-recorded dialogue and they went back and re-edited the movie so it will actually look better and sound better, which I don't know if you ever heard of that. I mean, that's kind of interesting that Peter O'Toole actually went in and redid some of his audio, which I, you know, it's kind of interesting hearing that.
I have not heard of that.
Yeah, the three of them also talked about home entertainment and the switch from the movie theater viewing to home viewing and how that will be more of a, not necessarily an issue, but more of a hot commodity nowadays, because George Lucas goes and says that in the 90s, they were already experimenting with high definition. They already had these prototypes, these high-def TV prototypes. He was saying soon, once people can get these, you know, 35, 45, 50, 60-inch televisions in their home, and if they also have THX surround sound or Dolby Digital surround sound or whatever, nobody will go to the movie theater. Theaters are kind of taking a toll because of that, because a lot of people are staying home because there is video on demand. And they're saying that, you know, one of the big reasons why a lot of theaters, movie theaters, at least at that time, are experiencing such a lull, or we're starting to experience kind of a lull in theater attendance, was because that people aren't being treated as well as how they used to be treated in previous decades. As in, like, how the picture and the sound is delivered, and how the movie theater owners exhibit movies properly, because a lot of people don't have the correct projected light to actually show the crisp and the well-lit and the well-cinematographied films. And so that can really turn people around. And actually, I think that a lot more people were more conscious of sound and the look of a movie back in the 90s and 80s and back then, other than now. And it just seems like a lot of people just don't really pay attention to that stuff, unless, you know, people like us or people that know a little bit about how a movie should look. But I think a lot of people just blindly go into a movie and just accept it for how it is. So I think a lot of theater owners and projectionists kind of get away with murder by, you know, not properly lighting a movie or not really keeping the projector clean or spotless or anything like that. However, the three of them think that nothing will replace the experience of going to the movies, because people want to get out of the house. I mean, this is another reason why a lot of people still go to plays, and this is what Spielberg and Martin Scorsese was saying, is that people like the experience of going somewhere, sitting down in a dark area and watching entertainment. And, you know, obviously a lot of people like to get out of their house. However, with these big surround sounds, people sitting down watching movies on their TVs and also with video on demand, more people will more than likely stay home, possibly. And lastly, it's the showmanship. And there's no showmanship when viewed at home. And that was their kind of like last closing remark. And I think it was Scorsese who said that, is that it's all about the showmanship. That's the reason why a lot of people go and see movies at the theater, because they don't get the same experience as they do at home. It's the smell of the popcorn. It's the people anticipating the movie. It's the people talking about the movie afterward. It's being able to converse with your friends and not having outside distractions. And it's just that whole ambiance that a movie theater produces that you really can't copy that feeling at your home unless you have millions upon millions of dollars and you can build your own movie theater and whatnot. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And again, this whole interview, I think it's about like 40 minutes long. It's on YouTube, and it was Siskel and Ebert, The Future of the Movies from 1990.
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm probably going to try and watch it.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Well, then let's just go ahead and jump into it. You want to go ahead and get into it?
Yes, sir.
Let's do it then. Here it is, the news. Yes, the news. Okay, and Tim, why don't you go ahead, since you have already enlightened us today, why don't you enlighten us further? Take it away, sir.
Yes, all right, so I have a rather eclectic jumble of news pieces to share with you folks. First off, author Elmore Leonard is dead at the age of 87. This is kind of a shame, because he is a prolific author, so I guess it is good that he did pass away at such a later age. He lived to be 87 years old. He has written numerous books that a lot of movies were based upon. For example, Out of Sight, 310 to Yuma, Get Shorty, and Jackie Brown, which is based on his book called Rum Punch. So again, Elmore Leonard passed away at the age of 87 years old. The new Steve Jobs movie opened this past week to, well, not really critical acclaim. A lot of people didn't really care for this movie. I think it's like at 27% or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes, if that means anything. See, Ashton Kutcher playing Steve Jobs himself. However, Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak watched the movie, and he has a couple little notes for Ashton Kutcher, and this is via cinemablend.com. This is what
Wozniak
had to say. Quote, "I thought the acting throughout was good. I was attentive and entertained, but not greatly enough to recommend this movie. I suspect a lot of what was wrong with the film came from Ashton's own image of Jobs," end quote. So that was kind of a compliment as well as an insult. He goes on to say that, quote, "Ashton made some disingenuous and wrong statements about me recently, including my supposedly having said that the movie was bad, which was probably Ashton believing pop press headlines, and that I didn't like the movie because I'm paid to consult on the other one. These are examples of Ashton still being in character. Either film would have paid me to consult, but the Jobs one already had a script written. I can't take creative leadership from someone else. And I was turned off by the Jobs script. but I still hoped for a great movie. End quote. So I guess for those that wanted to look for any more of a reason to not go and see this movie, I guess this is that reason right there. This is not the true story that everybody wants. I think there's another Steve Jobs movie in the works. So probably just wait for that one, because I'm sure that one might hit the nail right on the head a lot more. And also on Netflix, there's kind of a mockudrama called I, Steve, kind of like iPod, I, Steve, with Justin Long as Steve Jobs. It's from the Will Ferrell FunnyOrDie.com. And I think that movie, I, Steve, does a better job at representing the story and the creation of Apple better so than this movie, Jobs. So, I don't know. Again, I didn't see Jobs, so for those who think I'm wrong or have something to say about it, comment. All right, so Fox, the distributor of the once popular and wildly funny and the most overquoted movie of all time.
I see you're drinking 1%. Is that because you think you're fat? Because you're not. You could be drinking whole if you wanted to.
Napoleon Dynamite came out and apologized for Napoleon Dynamite's misleading Japanese title. And this is from cinemablend.com yet again, and they say, quote, "Due to the fact that some direct translations of movie titles can be confusing, it's not an uncommon thing for studios to change the name of their films when they are being released in foreign markets. That, however, was not what happened when 20th Century Fox first released the Jared Jerusha Hess-directed comedy Napoleon Dynamite in Japan back in 2006. Instead of keeping the original title, or at least changing it to actually reflect something about the movie, the company instead decided to rename it Busman. While this was partially excused by the fact that the opening scene of the indie takes place on a school bus, Fox's real motivation behind the title change was to try and link the film to an extremely popular growing franchise in Japan called Train Man. And now, a full 7 years after trying to deceive audiences, the studio is apologizing for their actions. Kotaku has picked up a story from Yahoo Japan that says Napoleon Dynamite will be getting a home video re-release this October, and the copies will be sold with a note from the studio that asks for the Japanese consumer's forgiveness. End quote. Interesting. And it's kind of nice, I guess, to hear them apologizing in such a way for doing something that I don't think maybe a lot of people really didn't catch on or really cared to catch on, because I've never heard of this. Maybe this was more of a outrage in Japan than here. But I know for a fact that Hollywood studios wouldn't do anything like this. They wouldn't put any money and go through the trouble of photocopying and printing off all of these letters and sticking them in home video releases. I don't think anybody really wants to take blame, but I guess thank you to Japan for doing this. It's kind of nice to hear.
Why do they care 7 years later? That's really what I want to know. I mean, do the Japanese just hang on to it with a fervent passion? You fucking lied to us, man. You lied to us 7 years ago. We shall avenge you. Sounds like, why do they care 7 years later? Just retitle it. Retitle it to whatever they think they should retitle it to and just put it out. Yeah, the Japanese guy that loves it because it's ironic that it's called Busman and he's only on the bus for like a minute. And then we're just like, what? Busman? I don't know. I think that's just a lot of time and effort for something that, you know, just might just be one of those cultural things. That's about all I can think of.
So moving on, Jerry Bruckheimer may possibly lose Final Cut on Pirates of the Caribbean Part 5, as well as the budget may very well be reduced. And this is why, via Collider.com, quote, "Though Disney tried its darndest to bring the budget of the Lone Ranger down before filming began, the price tag still clocked in at somewhere around $225 million. Add in a hefty Disney marketing campaign, and the Johnny Depp, Armie Hammer-fronted Western cost the Mouse House quite a bit. A month after release, the film has yet to even hit $100 million domestically, and its worldwide total currently sits at $175 million. The movie undoubtedly has problems, and Disney is taking steps to ensure that a similar situation doesn't happen again. The folks over at The Wrap report that Jerry Bruckheimer, who produced The Lone Ranger, may not receive final cut on the upcoming Pirates of the Caribbean 5, a privilege he enjoyed on the previous four Pirates films. Moreover, the studio is looking to shave the film's budget down from $250 million to a number closer to $200 million. The Lone Ranger's box office is indeed unimpressive, but coupled with the disappointing box office performance of last year's $250 million John Carter, the studio is trying to avoid pricey and public embarrassments becoming a trend in the near future. That being said, there's likely nothing to worry about box office-wise for Pirates 5, as audience turned out in droves for the lackluster on Stranger Tides. The movie going public loves it some Jack Sparrow, and the fourth film brought in over $1 billion worldwide. End quote. That could be a good thing. Maybe they'll have to rely more on props and sets and all that stuff, and not necessarily on a blue screen or any stuff like that.
I think it's time somebody smacked him in the face and showed him what's really what. I'm getting tired of his shit, personally. Seriously, it's just, this is getting completely out of hand. I think that a little bit of humility might go a long way.
Send him over to Japan. Make him learn a thing or two.
That's right. Just put him in charge of Busman, too. Okay, well, excellent news, Tim. Very good, sir. Awesome. So I've just got a couple pieces of news, nothing too world-shaking. First up, Hollywood Reporter, courtesy of Tatiana Siegel and Stephen Galloway. Look at that, I said their names right the first time this week. I don't know what the hell was my problem last week, but yeah. In case anyone didn't know, the juggernaut financing team of Warner Brothers and Legendary are now parting ways. They're going through their divorce. They're fighting over the kids, more or less. It's really kind of an amicable split. Legendary has teamed up now with Universal, but because of everything being, you know, in the movie world, being in pipelines and all that kind of stuff, they're having to split up the pictures. And even with stuff, future projects that have yet to be split up, they are still looking into trying to figure out things that haven't been made, and they're still going to be tied together for a few other projects that are already in the pipeline. But the cool thing is that Legendary, this is the title here, this is the headline, Legendary scores Christopher Nolan's Interstellar in Warner Brothers' divorce. Now, this is a very anticipated project here, and what we have is Legendary Pictures and Warner Brothers' 8-year union. Okay, it was considered one of the more successful co-financing partnerships in Hollywood history. So it should come as no surprise that the two companies are working out some shared custody with their cinematic offspring. Sources tell Hollywood Reporter that before its June split with Warner's, Legendary negotiated to retain a hefty stake in Christopher Nolan's sci-fi tentpole Interstellar, starring an ensemble cast including Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, and Casey Affleck. The arrangement still is being finalized, but sources say Legendary will finance 25% or more of the big-budget project, which began shooting August 6th in Alberta. The movie adds a third backer, along with Paramount, which will release the film domestically on November 7th, 2014. And, of course, Warner's is spearheading international. What we've got, though, is kind of a really cool thing here, because they scored this deal by saying, oh, hey, look, we've got rights to financing and money tied up into the next Man of Steel movie. Now, when that comes to the table, the same sources are saying that Warner CEO Kevin Tushihara wanted to keep the studio's DC Comics properties to itself and instead offered Legendary a stake in Interstellar. Considering Nolan's last three films as a director, The Dark Knight, Inception, and The Dark Knight Rises have grossed nearly $3 billion worldwide combined, Legendary CEO Thomas Tull jumped at the opportunity. Long story short here, they've done some really good deals here. And I can't stress enough how excited I am to see that the next big thing from Christopher Nolan is getting this much attention, that people are literally willing to trade stakes in other franchises and stuff just to keep working with him. To give you an idea, though, of the still tied together portion, Warner's is still in business with Legendary over Noam Murrow's upcoming 300 Rise of an Empire, also the new Godzilla. And so that's just, and these are big, this is big money stuff, okay? The film, Godzilla, has Legendary tied up for that for up to 75 to 80% of the budget. So they're definitely going to want a big, you know, they're definitely going to want lots of money coming in off that. So there's definitely some big movies coming in. Interestingly, though, Legendary still has several projects that were once expected to be distributed by Warner's that are no longer poised for that treatment. So among those are going to be Warcraft, which is based on World of Warcraft, and also Hot Wheels, Mass Effect, and Cyber, which is the Michael Mann movie starring Chris Hemsworth. It's now on Universal to see which of those pictures it wants to come aboard to co-finance. What do you think, Tim? I think this is kind of an interesting deal. Do you think it was a good trade?
They better hope that Interstellar makes a ton of money at the movie theater. It's just bizarre because they just kind of gave up a lot of potential franchises for one movie. I don't know. It depends. I mean, I think Christopher Nolan is a pretty good name to bank off of. And I forget who's in the cast of Interstellar.
Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, and Casey Affleck.
Okay, well, is that a big draw, like in Inception?
Exactly, it is, but that's just it. I think that they have a couple of recognizable names, not necessarily big movie stars. With Inception, of course, you had Leonardo DiCaprio, considered probably a big star. But here you've got Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway, both very bankable figures in terms of people know who they are, people are familiar with their faces and stuff like that. But then you've got also up-and-comers like Casey Affleck, who's got, you know, some pretty good acting chops as well. And that's where they kind of fill in, and that's where Christopher Nolan really shines, is that, you know, he can throw one or two pretty well-known names out there, but then he's going to fill in the roster with just an amazing supporting cast and just create an awesome movie. And from that, who knows what kind of spinoffs and merchandising and whatever else you can get. Not to mention, if they stick with Nolan specifically instead of a franchise that Nolan is just kind of tied to, Nolan's more likely to want to continue to work with Legendary, so they don't have to put all their eggs in the Superman basket. They can just stay with Christopher Nolan, who's been making quality stuff for 15 years. I think that it was a smart play, personally. I think that that was the better choice. Go with something that you're just going to be tied down to Superman forever, or go with the creative force behind Superman and get in line for everything he's ever going to do. Next up, from MSN Entertainment, Parallel Universe, and Don Cave at Parallel Universe, could Star Wars Episode 7 open in December 2015? Yes, are they going to go Lord of the Rings route? Turns out, with summer 2015 already looking like a movie tentpole pileup of epic proportions, Disney and Lucasfilm may be thinking about making the season just a little easier on everyone. It's because sources have told Badass Digest that execs at the combined companies are mulling over the possibility of opening Star Wars Episode 7 in mid-December of that year instead of the usual May slot that every previous Star Wars movie has filled. Now, if you just listen, I can sum this up in this paragraph why I think this is a good idea. Summer 2015 is getting more crowded by the minute with one behemoth after another. The Avengers, Age of Ultron, Batman vs. Superman, Pirates of the Caribbean 5, Independence Day 2, Assassin's Creed, Pixar's Inside Out, and also on the list of trying to get in there, Jurassic Park 4 and Terminator 5, all fighting for screen space and moviegoers' money. Now, with the possible exception of the Avengers, Star Wars is quite capable of dwarfing all those in box office returns. But since the Avengers is also owned by Disney, which owns Marvel, and is already locked into a May release itself, does the Mouse House really want to compete with itself and set its two monster franchises against each other? I gotta say, to answer that question posed, I really don't think it matters, but why not? This is a prime opportunity to not just make a good financial decision so that both movies can have a better chance at making the most money or making more money, but also to again set the standard that it's not George Lucas anymore. George Lucas would release in May. Now we're going to release in December. It makes good sense financially, and I think it's another subtle nod to the fact that George Lucas isn't in charge anymore. And I'm not trying to bash George Lucas, but I think that there's just too much trepidation after the prequels.
And I think that one more step that says we're treating it with respect, we're doing the right thing, we're doing what's right by the fans, but we are distancing ourselves from what was previously done is a smart move. And the article does go on to say that with less than 2 years to go before a presumed May release day, we're reasonably sure that Abrams, who doesn't like to be rushed, would be very happy to have an extra 7 months to finish the picture. Actually, we're sure he'd really appreciate an extra year and a 2016 release, but that's another story. I gotta say, honestly, this would be just a boon. I think it would put some smack down on any additional holiday stuff. I would be in line. I'd be in line no matter what, let's face it. But I'd just be really more excited to wait in the nice cool weather than in the hot weather. And last but not least news, coming to us from SlashFilm.com, Disney set Tale of Madness, entitled Escape from Tomorrow, gets October release. That's right, this comes to us from Russ Fisher. If you'll remember, a few months back, I reported that a guy had literally put together an entire film and then actually shot it on location clandestinely in Disney World. I believe a little bit of it was in Disneyland as well, but definitely all over Disney World. And it is a twisted tale of madness, and no one thought it was going to ever see the light of day beyond the film festival circuit, because how the hell is anybody going to slap Disney like that and then get away with it? Well, guess what, folks? One of the biggest buzz films at Sundance this year was a black and white super indie that charted one man's downward spiral into madness. Not the most unusual subject matter for a Sundance film, but Escape from Tomorrow has a very unusual hook. The feature debut from director Randy Moore takes place in a Disney theme park and was shot inside Disney properties in Anaheim and Orlando with no permission from the company. Furthermore, the lead character's crazed state leads him to stalk two teen girls and features some full-on nightmare hallucinations of Disney characters. It's fuel for Disney corporate nightmares. Many people thought that Escape from Tomorrow would never see release because of the Disney connection, but now it has a release date set for October of this year. Wow. From the LA Times, quote, PDA, the distribution offshoot of the sales and management company Cinematic Media, will release the film on October 11th, according to a PDA spokesman. It will play on movie theater screens in many of the nation's top markets, as well as be made available day and date on cable video on demand, the spokesman said, end quote. And yet still, even in this article, no word on how they got around Disney for this. I'm just really super excited to see this. We're going to have to figure out a way to do it. I've got to see this movie. That's just it. People did say that it was a little too far out there. Movie's been trimmed about 15 minutes, so apparently that's going to help. The person who wrote this article, again, Mr. Fisher, he did see this movie at Sundance, and he said it was really good, but he's also excited that they trimmed it down a little bit. So what do you think, Tim? I mean, do you think that Disney's just kind of saying, all right, you got us, let us go, or, I mean, is there some kind of legal maneuver that says, you know, we got away with it and you can't touch us? I don't know.
I think this is when we really need a entertainment lawyer correspondent for the show to come on and say, well, guys, actually, you know, they have paperwork in the briefcase to pull out and read. But, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, exactly. I really have no idea.
I mean, I suppose you could argue that it is parody.
Right.
And if you can successfully argue parody, then you're allowed to use copyright material for that. So, man, I don't know. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens in October, that's for sure.
It could be because of, like, the cameras they used, that they weren't, like, full-fledged movie cameras. Maybe there was a way to...
That might be true, because, I mean, people take home video all day long and post it on YouTube and do all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I suppose there's that outlet, but... I mean, we'll find out one way or another. But that's my news. That's it. That's all we got. You ready for our next episode of Masterpiece Discussion, sir?
Yes, sir. Let's discuss.
And welcome to our second edition of Discussions on the SLS Cast. Today, Tim and I are going to be discussing Hollywood Kids, how do young actors deal with sexy, violent roles? And comparing and contrasting that to the controversy of children in film. I am Matt.
And I am Tim.
And now we will begin our discussion. That part's never going to get old. I could do that every time. All right. So this is kind of a serious topic, though. I don't want to make light of it. Or overly make light of it. Basically, we kind of wanted to talk about, especially Tim had brought up a really good point when we were watching Silenced, about children who are put into a situation, especially in Silenced, where they're being graphically depicted on screen as being sexually abused, and especially in one scene where their boy is being molested by the teacher at the teacher's house in his bathtub, and then you actually see him kind of like rub his butt and the inside of his thigh and stuff.
And they're both naked.
Yeah, and they're both naked. So you kind of have to ask yourself, first of all, how is that even legal? Was there maybe a stand-in, a body stand-in or something? But it's a fair question. And so we found a couple of articles that discuss it. Tim found one from Variety, and that was the first article title that I had found and or that I read. And then I've got one from MasteringFilm.com, which is about the controversy of children in film, which has a little bit more of a detailed breakdown of some controversial content that was alluded to in the Variety article. So let's talk.
The article is entitled Hollywood Kids: How Do Young Actors Deal with Sexy Violent Roles? And this is written by Peter DeBruge. And it says, quote, after watching his mother die on AMC's The Walking Dead, Carl Grimes says his goodbyes and then shoots her in the head to ensure she won't come back as a zombie. Actor Chandler Riggs was 12 at the time he played the role. As entertainment continues to push the envelope, pundits debate how to protect the kids who watch. But what about young actors involved in telling these increasingly extreme stories? How does the industry protect them when they are called upon to perform scenes that involve violence, sexuality, and other mature content? In the adult-oriented comic book adaptation, Kick-Ass, the film's most foul-mouthed and ruthless character is a prepubescent crime fighter named Hit Girl, who delivers the line,
okay, you cunts. See what you can do now.
Chloe Grace Moretz was 11 when she shot the part and 15 for the sequel, which opens next month. Actually, it opened this past weekend. This year's Cannes Film Festival was full of international picks featuring young characters in edgy situations. In Palme d'Or winner Blue is the Warmest Color, teenage actress Adele Exarchopoulos. Adele Exarchopoulos plays a 15-year-old student who experiences her first lesbian encounter with an older woman. In Mexican drug war drama, Healy stirred controversy over a scene that depicts kids participating in horrific torture sequence that ends with the teen drug dealer's private parts being lit on fire. On stage, 13-year-old Bridget Fleming played a provocative role in the Center Theater Group production of The Nether, which take place in a virtual world where real adults manipulate a teenage girl avatar. The play implies that she is a sexual object for older men and features a scene in which she is murdered with an axe, an ordeal repeated night after night for the duration of the show's run. According to professionals, the first thing the public must understand is that the children are acting. What they experience on set is far different from what their characters appear to go through on screen, heightened for viewers' sake by body doubles, editing, and other filmmaking tricks. You either believe it or you don't, says Paul Peterson, the former Donna Reed Show regular who founded nonprofit org, a minor consideration to help counsel young performers about the pitfalls of celebrity, which extend to objectification off-screen, he says. I once played a young boy in the Ford Television Theater, where I witnessed my father hanged by the neck until dead. The impact on me as a developing child, it affected me like it really happened. Others insist that whatever their age, actors understand how to separate make-believe from real life, arguing that it's not the content of the performances, but the context in which the actors are raised that matters, with parents being the most important factor. As one insider put it, you have someone like Lindsay Lohan who made The Parent Trap, and she ends up a messed up drug addict, And you have someone like Jodie Foster, who played a drug addict and ends up just fine. In the case of Moritz, who plays a title role in the Stephen King remake, Carrie, this fall, those who work with the actress describe her as being unusually comfortable around tough material. Moritz started acting in 2001 and shot The Amityville Horror at age 6. On set, she is supported by her mother, older brother, Trevor, who executive produced Kick-Ass 2, and doubles as her acting coach, and longtime teacher, Sissy Torrance. According to Kick-Ass 2, director Jeff Wadlow, her EQ is off the charts. Her innate understanding of emotions is just mind-boggling. Considering Moritz's maturity level, the Helmer felt it was important to treat her the same way he dealt with his adult cast. When it came to particularly violent things her character would have to do, I feel like it's a disservice to the actor not to loop them in, he says. If you've created a safe environment where the actor can ask questions and we can talk about what's happening in an honest fashion, I think that's ultimately a lot more beneficial to the actor's growth and the effort to protect them as a minor than it would be to hide what's going on from them. When it comes to legal restrictions around working with minors, safety is the paramount concern, especially with regards to stunts. Other considerations vary from state to state, with California having some of the strictest child labor laws in the country. Nudity is absolutely forbidden, regardless of context. That Man of Steel scene featuring naked baby Clark Kent had to be shot in Vancouver. Real cigarettes are forbidden on set, and the number of hours a minor's works is rigidly enforced. On Kick-Ass 2, Wadlow designed his coverage so that he could complete it without Moritz if needed, a trick learned from producer Bill Bannerman on Never Back Down. But when it comes to moral context, the Labor Commission leaves it to the discretion of parents. The parent is number one in the children's lives. They have to decide what's best for them, says Coast to Coast agent Meredith Fine, who takes pride in matching her clients to appropriate material. Fine reps three of the young actresses in the R-rated haunted house chiller, The Conjuring, but insists it wasn't scary on set because there are lots of people protecting the kids. In other cases, something as innocuous as a Nickelodeon or Disney Channel series may cross a child's actor's comfort line. I do have clients who pass on projects because the material is too scary for them, or because a young girl is not ready to have her first kiss on screen, Fine says. You have to recognize what makes sense for your child. I think the success of these kids is that they have a good support team around them. In addition to parents or guardians, the law dictates that a social worker be present on set whenever minors are involved, usually in the form of unionized studio teachers, because the production pays the additional salary. They combine this role into one. I'm a teacher, social worker, and lawyer, says Tom O'Flattery, the studio teacher on The Nether. The parents are the first ones to make the decision if they want their kids to do this type of role. And then we're there as support system for the kid and for the family to make sure they're comfortable, safe, and taken care of in every aspect. We're the watchdogs. With The Nether, O'Flannery was hired by the production early on, giving input during rewrites and planning so playwright Jennifer Haley could portray the show's predatory virtual world without putting teenage Fleming at physical risk. As for the emotional demands, the actress was very aware of the material, O'Flattery says. She had done a lot of film and TV, so she had an idea how to portray a role like this. The Walking Dead executive producer Gail Ann Hurd felt similar confidence about working with Riggs, whom she describes as an actor, not just a child actor, explaining a lot of child actors essentially play versions of themselves, but if they need to go to a deeply emotional place or do something that they themselves in real life wouldn't do, they have trouble performing those scenes. Riggs had a chance to work his way up to the mom-killing scene over the course of 3 seasons. The young actor and his parents, who are both teachers, were familiar with the graphic novel and always received scripts, so there were never any surprises. You know going in that a lot of these characters are going to have a short shelf life, says Chandler's father William. The pilot featured a zombie girl being shot in the forehead. It's always very sad when we lose a cast member. We just talked our way through it. He has always understood that it's all pretend, but it's still difficult because Sarah Wayne Callias, who was very good to Chandler, and she treated him as a surrogate mom on the set. Problems most frequently arise when productions are unclear with parents about what a given role entails, says Children in Film founder Tony Casala. It's intimidating for parents to object. because they're afraid their kids may never want to work in this town again. The less experience they've had in the industry, the more they're willing to endure, says Casala, who points out that productions can take their content as extreme as they like because there's always some parent willing to sign their kids up for the role. Child performers don't really have a say unless their parents make them players. Peterson takes an even more extreme view, citing that the thousands of girls who auditioned for Adrian Lynn's Lolita remake, knowing the effect the less explicit original had on Sue Lyon. Remember, children are chattel, under the law. They belong to the parent, no different than a slave. Bad parental choices have consequences. For first-time child actors taking small parts, the parents and studio teachers may not have access to the full script. In other cases, masking the full nature of the role is the best way to protect the young performers. That's how Mexican Helmer Amat Escalante, who won director honors at Cannes for Healy, staged the film's shocking torture scene by clearly explaining to the 11-year-old extra and his parents that the young performer would be instructed to paddle an actor whose backside was exposed, then walk off set with his eyes closed. He would then hear screaming as the tortured actor's genitals were lit on fire via a computer-generated effect. We try to make it a fun atmosphere and to relive the attention with humor, especially in scenes where we're doing very difficult things, says Escalante, who was very protective of the young actors, all of whom were non-pros. It's very different in Mexico because children grow up much quicker. Part of the inspiration of making Healy was seeing 12 to 14-year-old children in Guanajuato going through some very difficult things for that age, says Escalante, who cites that the fact that a 6-month-old baby cast elsewhere in the film was accompanied on set by her 14-year-old mother. It was a minor taking care of a minor. Escalante says he was criticized at Cannes for filming the torture, but omitting a scene in which a 12-year-old girl is raped off camera. The decision was easy. I can't fake a young girl being raped, and that would traumatize her for life, he says. By contrast, Blue is the Warmest Color director, Abdelatif Kachich.
Wozniak
followed a waning tradition of casting a young adult, then an 18-year-old, to play the underage character. American productions have largely gravitated away from that practice, but on Blue, the director had no choice. Even so, the film has come under fire since opening in France for its difficult shoot. Originally scheduled for 2.5 months, the pick was extended to 5 months as the director shadowed the actress everywhere, on the subway to the club, even to the bathroom to observe her throwing up at one point, and even renamed the character after his young star. When Adele sleeps in her bedroom, it's me who's really sleeping, the actress told French magazine Le Nouvel Observateur, and when she and the co-star Leia play their intimate moments, Adele would spend weeks filming a single unsimulated sex scene. I'm not pretending that at the beginning we didn't feel uncomfortable, but the fact that Adele discovers this pleasure with a woman for the first time helped me a lot. In America, the law forbids minors from such content, but parents are the ultimate judge of whether a project that involves the same thematic material is appropriate for their kids. On The Walking Dead, Heard and her fellow producers took an extra step of offering counseling service to their young stars. All of our children actors also have access to a child psychologist in case they do have issues, she says. If a studio teacher notices something amiss, they have the power to shut down a production until the problem is solved. But the key is to communicate effectively in advance so everybody is on the same page, Casala says. It's really important that parents coming into this understand the business and how it can work without injury or have the guts to say no. End quote.
Well, okay, I'm going to contrast what you said with really just the points here in the opposite article with the controversy of children in film. I think that two things need to happen. One, I think that there needs to be a very proactive list of things going on to protect the kid. And so, for example, Bastard Out of Carolina, it's a 1996 movie based on a novel that is all about the sexual abuse of a child. And TNT was originally going to air it, and they said no, that was really Ted Turner. And so they went ahead and put it on Showtime, and it became the highest rated film on Showtime that year and won the Television Critics Award for Best Movie and Miniseries. And again, the sexually abused child Bone is played by, at the time, 11-year-old Jenna Malone. And there are two scenes in that film that feature the sexual abuse Bone experienced, one in a car and one inside a house. And while talking about the film and the controversy it caused, the executive producer, Gary Hoffman — it was actually directed by Angelica Houston — but Hoffman made the following observations. And this kind of really goes to kind of what the whole article is about. One, portraying the abuse with the emotional intensity felt by readers of the book was important to him, as was the need to ensure Malone's safety and well-being. Two, in the casting session for Bone, Jenna Malone was asked if she could handle the content of the script, which she had read with her mother. She said she could, and after reading an intense scene for the audition, she again became a carefree child, proving to Hoffman that she understood the difference between acting and real life. Three, during filming, he spent a lot of time with Malone's mother, making sure she and her daughter were comfortable with the film. Jenna's mother was on the set at all times, and she had no objections. Four, his son, who was the same age as Malone, played with her on the set in between scenes. Five, Ron Eldard, who played the abuser, rehearsed the abuse scenes with Malone and developed a close working relationship with her. Six, when asked about any long-term effects the role might have had on Malone, Hoffman said there is no way of predicting how someone will react years later. Seven, lastly, and most importantly for him perhaps, Hoffman stressed that the reality of what viewers see on the screen is not the reality experienced by the actors during filming. For example, Malone repeatedly told him how much, quote, fun, end quote, she had rehearsing and filming the scene in the house. On screen, it looks as if Eddard is lifting her up by her head, but in reality, she is holding on to his arms, which is what they had rehearsed. Hoffman's last point is in keeping with what other directors had to say, with, like, specifically with what Deborah Kempmeyer had to say in connection with Dakota Fanning and Hound Dog, where Dakota Fanning was doing, like, a rape scene, more or less, in that movie, where she wore a body stocking and whatnot. It's that the actor may not have experienced during filming what the viewer experiences, movies being make-believe, after all. So when you have someone, when you have a production team that goes out of their way to make sure that they have a kid that, as for all intents and purposes, they believe can handle the material, and they do everything in their power to make sure that the kid is experiencing make-believe, and then I think you're in good shape. But ultimately, what your article points to, what the Variety article points to, is that it really is up to the parents. And yes, there are some parents who are shitty parents. And even with the protections in place for kids, like having the counselor on set and stuff like that, you still got shitty parents who just don't care. They just want the money, or they just want to leech off the fame of their kid or whatever. And that's no good. But if you have involved parents, it's just like with anything else. Be a good parent. Be involved with your kid. Pay attention to their needs. And work with the people to make sure that your kid gets the best of the experience. And I think that it's okay. I still am bothered by what I saw in Silenced. However, once again, what you see as the viewer is not what happens when they're filming on set. So I have to have faith that if we want to see real stories and gritty stories and hard to tell stories that involve kids, we have to believe that it's being set up the right way, that it's being taken care of in such a fashion that kids are protected during the filming. Outside of that, you never can tell. Look at Amanda Bynes. You never can tell.
Right, and it's hard to tell in Silence if they are using a body double or not. I'm hoping that they are, because, I mean, I don't even think even in Japan, really, they can actually get away with having a grown man caressing and grouping.
True, but this was Korea, not Japan.
Korea. I think even there, because I don't even think we would be able to watch it here, if so. I don't think Netflix would even be allowed to stream it.
But there and again, you have, like, the baby Jor-El scene, right? Or Kal-El, or whatever it is. You know, naked baby. They had to film it in Vancouver because they couldn't film it in California.
But that's different, though. Nobody's caressing him in a sexual...
True, but I mean, the thing is that they weren't even allowed to film it in a naked baby. They couldn't film in California. So, distribution and what's legal and everything across international lines, well, who knows what could be legal. Again, I'm sure it was probably body double or something. I don't know. But
then you have to look for, like the girl from Poltergeist. and all these other young girls in horror movies. I mean, in Poltergeist, isn't she like covered in blood by the end of the movie? Whenever they pull her back out of the closet, or
I didn't think it was blood. It was like goop or crap or something, but I didn't think it was blood.
Well, there are movies when kids are covered in blood. And it's hard for me to not believe that that doesn't have a impact on a little kid. Now, I understand when, you know, we reach 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, dressing up as zombies, you know, for Halloween and getting all gory for Halloween. But I think when it's like a 4 or 5-year-old, there has to be like some damage going on with that, like kind of a little bit of traumatization.
And again, yeah, and again, that's when you have to have the faith in the system, because if you don't, then you're going to end up with never being able to see anything realistic. And then it's like, why do they have a 21-year-old person playing a 9-year-old? I don't get it. So personally, if any of my kids wanted to pursue acting and they really thought that it was something that was a passion for them that they could be good at and they wanted to try it, I would totally let them do it. I don't think I could have them do violent stuff, horror movie stuff, because for me, I don't think my kids are ready for that. Not to mention, I don't want my kids to be watching that. And so if I don't want them to be watching it, why would I want them to be making it? And it seems counterintuitive, and it seems like a double standard. So
exactly.
For me, if it were my kids, I wouldn't want them. And again, like you said, I don't want 4 or 5-year-olds at all doing that kind of stuff. 7, 8, 9, 10, okay. But even with Chloe Moritz, whatever, I thought 11, it was hilarious. I'm not going to lie. I did laugh at it, but I just thought to myself, there's no way I would let my 11-year-old daughter, I don't have one yet, but I would walk around and say, cunt. It's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, and that's what really turned me off from the first movie, why I didn't go see it at the movie theater, is because I didn't want to be entertained by an 11-year-old girl. And I will say, she is a terrific actress, and she has a great head on her shoulders, and she's a wonderful performer. I don't want to be entertained by that. And I'm just worried about how tasteful these movies will be, or movies that have been made, that people are making now or in the future, that are involving kids, either depicted being, you know, molested, or cursing, or, you know, killing somebody, or being killed, or something like that. If the movie is done tastefully, and again, everything behind the scenes is done right, you know, that's all great. But what if everything, like, the director's handling it great, but when you watch it as an audience member, the movie itself is not tasteful whatsoever? Is that still okay, or does that kind of mess everything up a little bit?
That's where I divide faith in the system that they're being treated properly versus what I personally would do. It would not be for my children, but I can divorce that. I can compartmentalize and say I can watch it. Like I said, I did laugh at Kick-Ass. I did think it was funny. I thought it was completely over the top, and I understood that it was intentionally supposed to be over the top in that regard. I still kind of found myself going, there's just no way I would ever let my kid do that. And I don't know. You got to take it on a case-by-case basis. I think 11's too young for any kid to be doing that. But as far as we can tell up to this point, Chloe seems to, like you said, have a good head on her shoulders. She could be that one in a million that can handle it and that can do well and will be okay in life.
Yeah, and also I really don't see how with that one Healy movie where they're talking about, okay, so this kid's in a scene where this guy is getting his dick lit on fire. And I'm trying to make light, or the director is like, I'm trying to make light of the situation and make things humorous. And it's like, the guy is getting his penis completely mutilated. I really don't see how, it would just be very interesting to see how he kind of tries to make things more humorous when the kid probably knows that's the scene that they're filming, you know, there's something kind of wrong with it. But who knows, they say that kids don't overanalyze certain situations as much as adults do, and they don't do any prejudgment or worry about a lot of things. So in closing, I guess what definitely makes a difference in this situation is A, the overall attitude on the set, B, a psychologist on hand to converse with both the parents as well as the young actor or actress, C, trick shots, D, the director is in close contact with parents, E, the young actors are just unaware of the content, just completely oblivious to what is going on, F, editing techniques, and then finally, G, young actors can understand scenes more so than older actors. And I mentioned that because there are a lot of older actors, say Heath Ledger that was affected by, you know, I guess The Dark Knight, which I think that kind of had a hand in him offing himself. And I read another article saying that, well, this is another reason why you don't see many young child suicides is because their psyche isn't there. You know, they don't ever think about letting certain things bother them because they just don't understand what's going on, unlike adults.
So next week will be the return of 3 Squared again. And Tim, tell us what next week's 3 Squared is going to be.
All right, we're going to be looking at directors making appearances and other directors' movies. So we're going to pick our 3 favorite directors that make appearances in other people's movies. For example, George Lucas made an appearance in one of the Beverly Hills Cop movies. He's in some way, it's well known that he was in that movie. So that is just an example. There are whole lists of examples out there on the internet. However, Matt and I will just pick our own personal favorite 3.
All right, so I guess it's time for the movies. That's right, the movies. All right, so this week's movies are Lee Daniels, The Butler, Kick-Ass 2, and The Conjuring. Then let's do it. Let's go from our least favorite to our most favorite. Okay, let's start off with Kick-Ass. All right, and for those of you that don't know, I don't know how you don't know yet, but Kick-Ass 2 is the 2013, just came out, obviously, sequel to Kick-Ass.
Ready to go again?
What do you want me to do?
Hit me.
You're a 15-year-old. Oh. What the hell?
Act like a bitch, get slapped like a bitch.
Oh, God.
Oh, take your tampon out, Dave.
They may wear costumes, but it isn't Halloween. They're real-life superheroes.
Me and Hit Girl, we're training every day. And there were more and more people joining us every night.
Colonel Stars and Stripes, reporting for duty.
A world full of superheroes. Where do they get a load of me?
I'm gonna make Kick-Ass pay for what he did to my dad. Henceforth, I'll be known as the motherfucker. You want more? I'm building an evil army.
Who is this guy?
He's claiming to be the world's first real supervillain.
What an asshole.
We're putting an end to this, costume freak. If they're wearing a mask, they're getting detained.
Promise me that you will never dress up in that outfit again.
Kick-Ass isn't a costume. It's who you really are. My daddy made me promise I'd never stop defending this city. I'd be paid for anything.
We gotta make this right.
The anticipation's killing me.
Again, it's the sequel to the 2010 film Kick-Ass, written and directed by Jeff Wadlow, and stars Aaron Taylor Johnson, Christopher Mintz Plasse, Chloe Grace Moretz, and Jim Carrey. Man, talk about where do you go wrong? Let's talk about what they did right.
I can think of one thing they did right.
Here's what they did right, okay? They ended the movie.
That and the subtitles are kind of cool.
Yes, the subtitles were pretty spiffy. You know what? I will say this. As terrible as this movie was, because what was so good about it, okay, it's one of those things where the thing that was good about the first movie for me was that it was intentionally over the top and completely unrealistic in terms of the level of violence, literally turned it into a parody of itself.
But at the same time, there was kind of a level of realism based on the repercussions.
Yes, and there was a level of realism. Yeah. That is correct. There was that level of realism to it. Here, it's kind of like, look, we're going to do it again, only this time we're going to throw a whole bunch more money at it so that you can get sick of looking at it within the first 10 minutes. And then we're just going to keep on doing it for the rest of the movie. And they just beat it to death. And that's hard to do in a movie where everything gets beat to death. Taking that away from it, though, I will say that Christopher Mintz Plasse's character of the motherfucker, I did like his constant, the way that they wrote him with his constant tropes and his all of his one-liners and stuff that were throwbacks to great superhero movies. For instance, wait till they get a load of me, Batman, having the ultimate villain secret lair. just like every supervillain. However, Austin Powers with the shark tank by the end. I think it would have been fantastic if they had just put lasers on the sharks. So those little things that they did to pay homage, you know, to previous supervillains and what have you, that I thought was okay. Other than that, honestly, I just really think this movie is a complete waste of time. It was just everybody trying to cash in on the success of the first one. And I think everybody was like, oh, we're just going to make a ton of money on this. We can still pay people pretty well, have some fun with this thing, and then watch it just roll in dough. When they try to be serious, it doesn't come across as sincere. When they have fun, there's not enough of that, because then they go over the top with everything. Just, this movie's a mess. It really is. It's all over the place. This review is all over the place because there's just so much bad shit to pick out about this movie. 2 stars. I'm not going to say I hated it, but I really didn't like it.
Wow, 2 stars. I think this was possibly the worst movie I have seen all year. Possibly the worst movie I have seen in the past 2 years. Possibly.
Wow, 2 years.
Maybe.
Good Lord, man.
And that might...
No, I...
Oh, go ahead.
I gotta say, I'm sorry. I don't hate this movie. I don't, because I can appreciate what it tried to do. It just did it all wrong, and that's why... I think it's a pity, 2 stars. I think if I have to go on just basic filmmaking and the fact that they destroyed what made the first one good, 1 star. But the fact that I appreciate what they tried to do, I'm going to pity it. I'm going to throw out a pity star. So I stand by 2 stars, but I can totally understand why you are hating that. I just... Wow, in the last 2 years?
I think so. I mean, I might be... over-exaggerating, but just what really gets me is that the first Kick-Ass, the first movie, sets up kind of like what you were saying, is that they have, everything is a little over the top, however, there is this level of realism where there is a cause and effect for every crazy, stupid superhero. Actually, these are not superheroes. These are super violent vigilantes. They take the name superhero and in the butthole. These are vigilantes. So whenever these vigilantes go out and try to save the city, try to do good, a lot of the time these guys get screwed over. With Hit Girl's father, Big Daddy, he gets killed. He dies a horrible death. And actually, that's one of the best scenes out of the entire movie, is because that's kind of when the movie turns into an oh shit moment. Like, oh shit, this is the ultimate repercussion. Hit Girl's character is based upon the relationship she has with Big Daddy. And when her icon, her idol, her father is taken away from her, you don't know how she's going to turn out. She doesn't know how she's going to turn out. She doesn't know whether to follow in his footsteps or become a regular girl. And this is kind of what she experiences in the sequel. However, I really don't know where to begin with my criticism for Kick-Ass 2. So I'm just going to kind of go down the list. I just don't understand the new look to this movie. They completely got rid of the stylized technical aspects that the first one had. The first one has the establishing shots. Whenever there's action going on, you can actually see what is happening. You can see the special effects. You can see the stunts. You can see the action. You can see the scenery. With this movie, it's cramped. It's not like a comic book. Comic books, there's more visualization to it. The technicality is more thought out. This movie just felt rushed, and with a ton of information just kind of thrown into it, just to make what they think is a philosophical, thought-provoking movie, which is just going through and completely denouncing what they were preaching about in the first movie. So I just didn't like this new look. The characters, they're just all petty. Stakes are low in this movie, especially for Hit Girl. The plot is rushed and forced for the sake of setting up the next gag or the next part of the plot. Hit Girl goes from fighting evil villains to fighting bitchy schoolgirls in high school. There are a lot of throwing away characters like General Stars and Stripes and Kick-Ass's old girlfriend. It's like, to move the story along, they just kind of get rid of characters. It's like whenever General Stars and Stripes, Jim Carrey's character, dies, nobody ever really feels bad about the character. I mean, there's never really any remorse. I mean, that doesn't really fuel the fire. That doesn't really make the character of Kick-Ass want to get rid of the motherfucker even more. So therefore, what's the point of there being General Stars and Stripes? There really is no point to him being there. I mean, the only reason why he's in the movie is so he brings the team together. that is it. And he was one of the best characters of the entire movie. I think if anybody was going to bring any heart and any kind of true to humanity emotional connection or emotional feeling, it would have been his character. And he's in the movie for, what, maybe 15, 20 minutes, and they kill him off. The first Kick-Ass had these characters putting themselves in harm's way and endangering themselves, but then suffers the consequences. However, the sequel takes that ideology and removes the real-life aspect and replaces it with fast-paced fight scenes and other generic superhero cliches. If there are lessons to be learned in this movie, or if there is any philosophical reasoning or motive that these characters are emulating, I don't buy it. There were some lessons and repercussions in the first movie, but with Kick-Ass 2, shit don't make any sense. The only good thing about this movie is the use of subtitles within the comic bubbles, whenever, you know, the Asian guys are speaking. And to me, by watching this movie, it goes to show that a number of writers and producers and filmmakers out there that make these kind of movies are out of touch with younger generations, especially high schoolers, because it seems like every high schooler has to be played bitchy. There are all these cliques, which I think now, especially in this current generation, there is a lot of assimilation within cliques, to where I don't think there are as many cliques and as much partitioning going on within high school. And finally, this movie says that you cannot trust the cops to protect its civilians. Therefore, you should search for the criminals and invoke the violence. This is what I got from this movie. Unlike the first one, where it kind of has a message, if you can even come up with a message if there really is not a message, but this one is just basically saying, well, violence is good. If you need something done, use violence. The police aren't going to do anything, so you should. And that's basically all I got from Kick-Ass 2. I enjoyed the first one. I despise this one. I just really didn't find anything entertaining or original about it.
Could not agree more. I guess let us move on to The Butler. I'm sorry, Lee Daniels' The Butler, because we don't want to confuse it with a silent film from 100 years ago.
Or we don't want to get sued.
Correct. So let's see here. This is a movie that is inspired. Okay, remember, folks, inspired by the real-life account of Eugene Allen, who was a butler in the White House and covered like 10 presidents or whatever.
Are you political, Mr. Gaines?
No, sir.
Good. We have no tolerance for politics at the White House.
I'm Cecil Gaines. I'm the new butler.
You hear nothing, you see nothing. You only serve.
You know he got that job himself. The White House called him. He didn't call the White House.
I want to hear all the stories.
I don't know how many stories you're going to hear, because they done swore him to some kind of secret code. I'm so proud of you.
Did you go to an all-colored school, Cecil?
I didn't go to school, Mr. President. I grew up on a cotton farm.
Get back to work.
Don't you lose your temper with that man. It's his world. We just living in it.
About time you go ahead on your own.
You looking for some help?
You done broke our window. You done stole our food. And now you asking for a job?
I know how to serve.
They say this new white boy's smooth.
I am thrilled to be working with all of you over the next 4 years.
Dr. King.
What do your daddy do?
He's a butler.
Young brother, the black domestic play an important role in our history.
Something special is going on down here, Dad.
Mr. President?
I know your son is a freedom rider. I never understood what you all really went through. You've changed my heart.
There's this whole black power movement going on. I gave him the green light to gut those sons of bitches.
You know what they're gonna do to you? They're gonna kill you.
This country treats us like dogs.
And I'm not president.
We need to go.
What?
Get the hell out of here!
I'm sorry, Mr. Butler. I didn't mean to make fun of your hero.
Everything you are and everything you have is because of that butler.
there you go. Again, this movie was inspired by, okay? It's directed by Lee Daniels, written by Danny Strong, stars Forest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey, with a slew of cameos by famous people, from Mariah Carey to Robin Williams, James Dumont, James Marsden, who I thought actually was pretty good. The most surprising one for me, not because I don't think he's a good actor, but just because I really wasn't expecting him to pull it off, was Alan Rickman, who played Ronald Reagan. But you get Liev Schreiber as LBJ, John Cusack as Richard Nixon. You got Lenny Kravitz is in there as well. I was surprised. I forgot that I noticed Cuba Gooding Jr. So you got a ton of people in this movie who experience the life of as he goes through it. Here's my thing. This is basically supposed to be a celebration of a man's life who seemingly touched a lot of people because of his job. And the thing is that there's a much, much better movie that does a much better job of doing this. And it's called Being There, okay? It's the 1979 comedy drama that was directed by Hal Ashby. And it was adapted from a book, so they at least admit that this is fiction. And it stars Peter Sellers, Shirley MacLaine, Jack Warden. And it's about a guy who's a simple gardener and butler for an old wealthy man. And he is just, he's really simple-minded, but he has this kind of effect on people that causes him to get put into bigger and bigger situations. If you want to see a good version of The Butler, watch Being There. Because you get the point of the movie, which is that one person, no matter how seemingly insignificant their role, can truly change lives and people and interact with things. And you don't have to be made to feel bad about being a white person. You don't have to sit there and watch how horrible black people were treated for the better part of 2.5 hours. It's really like 2 hours and 12 minutes or something. But I mean, the movie starts off with a rape and a murder. What the hell? I mean, this is just stupid. I'm just tired of having black people got beat up on. We get it. The civil rights movement was important. We get it. We're glad it happened. You know, but I'm sorry, I'm 36 years old, and I can goddamn tell you that wasn't me. I don't want to see this stuff anymore. I'm tired of seeing it. I'm tired of having it rubbed in my face. And, of course, this movie's going to get all sorts of accolades and all sorts of nominations and stuff. And it's all political. This movie is really not that good. 2.5 stars. It's an okay movie, and I just don't like being preached at. And I'm tired of being preached at, and that's what kills this movie. If you want to see a really good version of this movie, just watch Being There.
I don't really know if I can agree with the comparison to Being There, but I do agree with the civil rights thing that they were kind of talking about through the movie, is that I think the first half of the movie, it is just in your face completely, like the scene where his son is on the Freedom Rider bus, and they're driving through, I think it's Alabama or Kentucky, one of the southern states. Their bus gets surrounded, and all these like slow motion panning shots of like people with torches and fire, and then this white guy comes up to the window, and how he talks, it's like they kind of slowed his voice down so he sounds demonic. I guess they were doing that as more of a symbolism. They did that a lot in this movie. There was just a lot of symbolic aspects at the beginning, first half of the middle, that nearly ruined the whole experience for me. One of the things that saved it was the butler character, Forrest Whitaker. How he portrays the character of, well, you know, we got to do what we got to do. If we want to beat the white man, you know, if we want to do better for ourselves, we just have to go with the flow and kind of beat the system from within. And, of course, the son doesn't listen to that. The son is completely against it. However, by the end of the movie, Forrest Whitaker, the butler, kind of lightens up about it, understands where his son is coming from. And correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, but I also believe that the son understands where the father is coming from and lightens up on their side, because he ends up joining the Black Panthers. And then he starts seeing how violent the Black Panthers becomes. That kind of pushes him away from that whole group. And so then he goes and he follows his dad's word by basically trying to become a congressman, by becoming some kind of U.S. delegate and just changing things from within the system, other than just completely attacking the system from the outside.
I do agree with you there. And on a side note, my issues with the film are not in regards to things like the acting. The performances are actually good. Forest Whitaker, for me, has always been an underrated actor. But I would say, yes, I agree that it is the influence of his father. But all kids do that. All kids have to try and find their own way. And it's like I've always said. It's a phrase that my stepdad actually taught me. After about the age of 21, 22, it is just amazing how much smarter your parents get, like, every day. And it's true, and it's the same thing that happens here. It's a kid trying to find his own way, not understanding the resolve and the courage and the grace that it takes to stand in the face of your oppressor and behave with the utmost dignity. And I think that's the lesson that he takes from his dad, and that's why he tries to change from within. But again, it's just pounded into your face over and over and over again.
Right.
And even despite those good things that come from the relationships and the interplay between the characters in the movie, it's drowned out by the white people bad. It just pisses me off because there's so many better ways to tell a story like this. How about you just actually tell the real story of Eugene Allen instead of just going, well, there was a guy who was a butler for 10 presidents and... instead of just doing his life, which must be pretty fucking remarkable, let's just make up a whole bunch of shit so that we can get some Academy Awards and make white people feel bad.
And I'm also not one to really let stuff like that really, like, bother me. And I will say that the first half of this movie, all that content, it's very noticeable. Very, very noticeable. And I gotta say that Cuba Gooding Jr., who I thought, for the most part, did a pretty good job in this movie... what got me is that, why did his character have to be such a sexist pig? It's like every line, in the first like 45 minutes of the movie, he had to talk about tits and f***ing a chick. Like, it just seemed thrown in there just to kind of have comedy to the movie. And they were trying to throw in this kind of like the African-American humor, these little African-American stereotypical sayings in the movie, just to make it more appealing and make it funny. And I think I can answer that. And I don't know, Matt, if you realize who the director is, Lee Daniels, but he also directed one of our favorite movies of this year called The Paperboy. The Paperboy is also known...
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah. was known for having characters, you know, just talking about ridiculous things, like a character just ranting and saying things like what Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character is saying. Just making the audience wonder, like, why is it in that movie? Does it not make any sense? And also, like, the big meals that they have in The Butler is fried chicken. And he made sure that was all in the movie The Paperboy, because Macy Gray's character, who plays the maid or the nanny in The Paperboy, who actually, I just read an article today that Oprah Winfrey was originally asked to play that role. She made a big deal about how fried chicken, the white family was going to eat fried chicken. And, you know, that was a big thing. And then again, fried chicken in The Paperboy. So I got to go back and watch Precious to see if fried chicken was a big food staple within that movie as well. So I think what it comes down to it is that I really don't think Lee Daniels is all that fantastic of a visionary. He's not all that great of a director. Especially after reading what Oprah Winfrey kind of mentioned something about, if Lee Daniels had his way, then I, again, this is not the exact quote, then I would be dropping F-bombs all the time. I'd be naked in the movie. And with saying that about Oprah, I will say that my favorite performance in the entire movie was Oprah's performance, and I was not expecting that. I thought she was terrific. I thought her makeup throughout the entire movie was really good. Oh yeah, and that's another thing, the makeup was wonderful, the old age makeup, and especially the young age makeup done on the older brother, who I think the older brother is a full-grown man, and, you know, they had to make him look like he was in high school and in college.
And I don't appreciate the heavy-handedness of it, but as a history major, and you as a history minor, I think it affects us. I suppose it's smart to look at it through the lens of it affects us differently as students of history who understand that these things did happen, and we know and remember that, and we take that into our lives, where most people do not. Unfortunately, I just don't want these very same people, I don't want their only history lesson to be these movies. Alright, so, on to the last movie, The Conjuring, which is the supernatural horror film directed by James Wan, stars Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson as Ed and Lorraine Warren, and is based on their true story, and at least they had some initial input into this, so you know, you gotta give it that. And follows them as paranormal investigators who come to the assistance of the Perron family, headed by Mr. and Mrs. Perron, played by Ron Livingston and Lily Taylor, and they're experiencing the increasingly disturbing events of a cursed farmhouse in Rhode Island back in 1971. So, take a listen.
All right, it's 9:18. We're headed down into the cellar where the door's just opened on its own. Give us a sign that you want to communicate with us.
Nothing.
What are you guys?
Well, we've been called ghost hunters, paranormal researchers.
But we prefer to be known simply as Ed and Lorraine Warren.
There's someone here that would like to talk to you.
There's something horrible happening in my house.
It's November 1st, 1971. I'm sitting here with Carolyn Perron, who, with her family, has been experiencing supernatural occurrences.
You picking up anything in here, hon?
Something awful happened here, Ed.
What is it?
All right, so I gotta say, this movie for me, I'm gonna go with 3.25 stars overall over this. It's not quite 3.5 star movie, but this is a film that does well because it doesn't try too hard. It uses very clever tricks to scare you, very subtle techniques, even though there's a lot of, you know, of course, floating and dragging around and, you know, all of the things falling. But the best part about this is that it uses your own imagination against you, because there's no blood. There's nothing. I gotta say that loosely. There's a little bit of blood, but by horror movie standards, there's like no blood. This is one of those things, it's bolstered by very strong performances. These are people who just really act the parts very, very well. They don't pretend to be anything that they're not. And they don't oversell it, especially, which is really easy to do when you're playing people who are devout Christians. And you see the characters played by Ed and Lorraine Warren, and one of the things that really ties their relationship together is that they believe that God put them together for a reason. And it's something that's very easy to oversell and to overact, but they play it with the conviction of the people who lived it. And it's those kinds of things that add to the performance, that give it a really solid performance, that make the movie worth watching. This is definitely a good movie. I by no means think it's the best movie out there. It's a solid performance, but there's just a lot of key elements that have just been beaten to death. For example, the part that is played by Lily Taylor, who is the mom in the Perron family, she's got a lot of things that are happening to her throughout the movie, and she constantly dismisses them in front of everybody else when she knows there's something wrong. And if you're that convinced that you need to go and get paranormal investigators to come to your house because you're being haunted, you think it would be wise to go ahead and say, oh, I've got these bruises all over me. It's not anemia. It's I'm being attacked. And it's just stupid stuff like that that they use. And it's like, come on. It's those kinds of things that detract from the film, because they use those things to advance the plot, to make it wait longer before you can really discover what's going on and really discover the truth behind the mystery, behind the haunting. And they do it throughout the movie. They intentionally set things up as plot devices that are just way too obvious. The things like Lorraine Warren, she has a locket, and the locket mysteriously ends up missing and stuff like that, and nobody figures that out. And this, and of course, they have to use the locket to make some things happen later on that work in concert with trying to get rid of the evil that haunts this house, because it's not a ghost. No. But again, these are the things that detract from the movie, and that's why I only give it the 3.25 stars, because I did like this movie. And one of the things that I really liked about this movie was the fact that it really uses your own imagination against you. It's not gross. It's not gory. And it proves that a good horror movie doesn't have to be. And the other really good thing to take away from this movie, again, is the performances are very, for the most part, very believable. And I like that when they were covering Ed and Lorraine Warren, they really treated their, as the people that they portrayed, they really treated them and their beliefs with respect. And that's something that you just don't see a lot anymore. Honestly, I haven't seen it treated this well since the original Exorcist. That was really the last time that I had seen religious iconography really being demonstrated in a viable way that uses it as the necessary plot device it must be, but without trying to oversell it.
I gave it 4 out of 5 stars.
Okay, fair enough.
I thought this was well made, and I thought this was a very good movie. I thought the relationship and love interest between the Warrens, the demonologists, was, to me, a little unrealistic. I thought the whole God brought us together, and just every time they would kind of break away and have their little moment, I thought it was hammy. I didn't buy it. It just seemed like that was going to come into play later on in the movie. More so than the Locket thing. That was definitely another in-your-face. Guess what? This is going to happen as well. But I thought this was really good. The use of more practical effects was an ingenious idea. I mean, I don't think I shouldn't say an ingenious idea, because I think more movies are incorporating practical effects rather than just doing all-out special effects. But how they did it, they just did it in such a limited way that it just worked. And for as many scares and as many high tense moments this movie has, to me it's just amazing how it just works. This was definitely a good time at the movies.
All right. Well then, I believe that brings us to the end of yet another episode of the SLS Cast. The movies for next week are going to be The World's End, Melancholia, and Iron Sky. The latter two are available on Netflix. And as a bonus, both Tim and I are going to try to see The Grandmaster. So if we can, it'll be a movie-packed episode next week. We're not sure if we're going to be able to see The Grandmaster or not, but we are going to try. And The Grandmaster is the new biopic on Ip Man. And I believe, sir, it is time for the spiel, yes?
Spiel on.
Alrighty. The music you've been listening to, as always, has been provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can catch them at criesofsolace.com, reverbnation.com, and myspace.com, and facebook.com. The last three you can do /Cries of Solace. Of course, we are still the SLS Cast, and you can go to our website, slscast.com. You can send us email to theslscast@gmail.com. You can even follow us on Twitter @theslscast. Go to Facebook, search for the SLS Cast and find us there. And of course, subscribe to us on iTunes. And so until next week, this is Matt saying that thanks to Christian Bale, I get to say a movie star is someone people look at and go, I want to be like that person. There's the responsibility of desire. It's not something I'm interested in trying. I would fail miserably at it, so why even bother?
And this is Tim saying, cheers, y'all.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.